Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and from Washington, D.C., Libby Casey of APRN. The legislature hears oil industry testimony on oil taxes, and the testimony renews the debate on the proper level of taxation here in Alaska. Paul, give us the setting, the scene, and the outcome.
The three major North Slope oil producers sat down with legislators this week to talk about ACES, Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share Oil Tax. And the conclusion that they all gave, they all agreed, that ACES makes Alaska not competitive on the world market for their investment dollars. BP alone will invest $20 billion this year on exploration and such around the world. Alaska finds itself not in that, not in the market for that anymore because of ACES, they say. Legislators were looking for some assurances. Well, if we cut ACES, if we reduce the amount of taxes, what's that going to mean for jobs? What's that going to mean for investment? And they weren't willing to give them any assurances. And I think it's all market driven. I can understand that. But that's what they were looking for at this point.
Paul, Steve, this is kind of the script one would expect if one was advancing a script. Mm-hmm. As industry comes and says, we're being hurt by this.
Yes.
Legislature says, well, what are you going to do for us?
Right. And there are no assurances. You've got a number of very skeptical lawmakers, including Republican Hollis French in the Senate,
Les Guerra.
Democrats. Hollis French in the Senate and Les Guerra in the House. They were the driving forces behind the Sarah Palin's administration's efforts to enact ACES several years ago. So they're the ones who are probably most skeptical. They do want some kind of assurance from the oil industry that, yeah, we're going to hire lots of people and drill lots of oil wells and up production.
And in fairness to the industry, they'll always say, well, it depends on the price of oil and what's going on in other places and a whole bunch of things we can't predict.
Yeah, it's not just taxes. This is just one of many factors that they use to determine where they're going to explore. And right now, they're saying that Alaska is one of the least friendly places to do business in the United States and because of the tax structure. The governor, his proposal would pretty much, I guess, bottom line, there's the progressivity clause that's in ACES. It would cap that, and it would cost the state about $5 billion over five fiscal years. And right now, we've got $11 billion in the state treasury in a savings account. Governor Parnell's his argument is we don't need any more in the savings account right now. Let's see if we can.
I want to put
production.
Alaskans to work, said the man.
Right. And what else have you got? I mean, if you're on the state's end of this, what else can step in and take the place of oil right now? We get about 85% to 90% of the state's revenues comes from oil. There's nothing out there that can replace that kind of money if this continues to dwindle.
Let's turn to Libby Casey. Libby, President Barack Obama unveiled his 2012 budget. What's in it for Alaska?
Well, there are some cuts in there, Michael. The president proposes to cut about $1 trillion away from the deficit over the next 10 years or so. And in the short term, he wants to kill or cut back about 200 programs. Now, you've heard of Republicans complaining and saying he's not going far enough. He didn't talk about entitlement programs at all. And he does want to boost spending in some areas, like energy, education. Let's look at the Alaska programs. The Denali Commission does survive and gets $12 million from the president's base budget. And the Denali commissioners are pleased with that. But about $10 million would be cut from the Denali Commission's program that helps build local health clinics. That would basically kill that program. It would still operate on some basic level, but the meat would be gone from it. Projects that would be affected right now are in places like Willow and Huna and Shishmaref. Now, the president and his staff have said, look, it's not like all these programs are wasteful spending. I talked to Gene Sperling on the Council of Economic Advisors, who held a briefing with reporters, who said, Denali Commission sounds great, but we just can't afford it anymore. You have to make some cuts. Other areas that would be cut, the high energy cost grants program, which sends money to utilities in rural areas where rates are especially high, and then the LIHEAP program. You've heard national stories about how the president wants to cut that in half. Mm-hmm. That's the program that sends funds to utilities in rural areas where, or urban areas even, where struggling families are having a hard time paying.
Libby, if I might, how is our budget, our section of the budget, doing in the House of Representatives under John Boehner's administration? Do we know yet what's in there, or is it too much of a changing document?
Okay, so this is where it gets really complicated. The president's budget deals with next year, fiscal year 2012. What the House is working on right now is the budget for fiscal year 2011. So Don Young and the other House Republicans are working through a process right now of trying to cut money from the budget we're currently working under. Don Young's had a couple of amendments that have had some floor time. One got voted on today that he's pleased with. It's an ongoing process, and this is all part of a continuing resolution to keep the government going. The president made some of the same recommendations last year to cut programs, like the Denali Commission for Alaska, but that budget never actually got accepted. So we're in this continual
sort of two separate decks of cards, and the way it works with the budget is only when you get the final passed document can you be sure of anything, right?
That's right. So we're watching to see what the House does in the next 24 hours on the continuing resolution, the current budget. Then that gets bounced over to the Senate. Some things the House is talking about cutting is funding for public broadcasting. Today they passed a resolution, part of an amendment that would strip funding from Planned Parenthood clinics. But this is all just part of the process. Anything that the House does this week still has to go back to the Senate and meet with senators' approval over there.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's return to Anchorage. Steve, Anchorage is about to have a municipal election, and finally we have learned or obtained the list of candidates who have filed to run for the Anchorage Municipal Assembly and for the Anchorage School Board. Yeah. For starters, it is a long one.
It is. In April, of course, the municipal election. There are, in the Assembly race, there are six seats up. All of those seats are currently held by incumbents. In West Anchorage, you've got Harriet Drummond, you've got Elvie Gray Jackson in Midtown, you've got Mike Gutierrez in East Anchorage. Out in South Anchorage, it's Chris Birch, who's up for re-election. You've got Bill Starr in Eagle River and Patrick Flynn, who's downtown. The three candidates who've really been targeted in this race, I think, are the ones straight up the middle there, the Harriet Drummond in West, Elvie Gray Jackson in Midtown, Mike Gutierrez in East Anchorage. The mayor's targeted them. He would like to see more conservative candidates who would conceivably be more friendly to his agenda and to his administration. He'd like to see those three people beaten. So he's backing the candidates. Liz Vasquez is running against Drummond. You've got a gentleman by the name of Trombley who's run before. He's running against Gutierrez out in East Anchorage, and Dave Ronson is running against Elvie Gray Jackson in Midtown. The most interesting race, I think, right now, though, to look at is the one in East Anchorage with Gutierrez. It's a conservative district. It's a very, very conservative district, and he's a more liberal-leaning incumbent. He's got Trombley, who is considered conservative and has the backing of Mayor Sullivan, but then you've also got Paul Bauer, who held that seat 3 years ago. In fact, it was Gutierrez who beat Bauer, and he's very conservative. He's a Tea Party member, helped in the early stages of the Miller campaign. That's right. So if you look at it right now, I think there's pressure on Bauer to get out of that race. I don't think he's going anywhere. But if you look at it right now, you could see Trombley and Bauer splitting the conservative vote, and that would certainly help Gutierrez.
Let's turn to Paul Jenkins. Paul, in your judgment, what are the possibilities or the likelihood that the mayor will prevail and change significantly the makeup of the assembly, make it more conservative?
Well, there's certainly the city's fiscal woes will play into this. The labor contract signed a few years ago, that'll play into it. In the last election, the mayor also supported two conservatives and a moderate, Ernie Hall.
Right.
Ernie Hall won, the two conservatives did not. So he's got about a 33% win percentage. So we'll have to wait and see how this one runs.
I'm always surprised that mayors do this because really their batting averages
capital.
Over
I'm
the
fine.
Years. Yeah, it, it's it's not very good. I can remember Tom Fink, for instance, backing several slates of conservative candidates. I don't think any of them won. I could be mistaken. It was a long time ago. But I think when mayors get into these things, they tend to
It's sort of irresistible,
out.
Don't you think?
Oh, well, certainly. You want somebody who you want an assembly that's more more conducive to what you believe in. But at the same time, if you're going out and campaigning, and it's his right and privilege to go off and do that, the mayor. But that guy, your guy loses, all of a sudden you've got a new assembly member who's very irritated with you and may not be willing to listen to any of your proposals.
Let's turn back to Libby Casey. Libby Casey, Alaska air carriers, their subsidies will continue. This is really important. It means millions of dollars here in Alaska. It also means mail service to some places that are very small. Tell us about the deal that was cut and how it will play out.
Well, the Essential Air Service program subsidizes flights to rural Alaska. 44 communities benefit from it. About 38 of those are entirely off the road system. And it's money to a tune of about $12.5 million for Alaska. Now, it's used in other parts of the country as well. $200 million is the price tag annually. And so some critics, like Senator John McCain of Arizona, said, hey, if we're going to cut spending and get serious, we've got to start somewhere. And guess what? This is one of those programs. So he had an amendment this week that he was trying to put in the FAA reauthorization that would have basically shut down the program, defunded it. What does it mean for Alaska? Communities like Cordova and Yakutat both got over $2 million last year. Funter Bay got about $8,000. So it's the bigger communities, the smaller communities, and it helps pay for flight so that if you're flying in and out of those communities, it's an affordable rate. Senator Begich and a couple other Democrats led the charge to get McCain's amendment killed. They were successful yesterday, and Lisa Murkowski's also been a longtime supporter of the Essential Air Service. And they both made speeches on the floor this week. Senator McCain took to the floor as well to talk about this, and he brought up a couple points that are worth thinking over for Alaskans. He was a little bit sarcastic and said, you know, when I brought this up, I didn't realize it would be the end of Western civilization as we know it to stop this program, but apparently to some people it is.
Doesn't it begin, at some point, Senator McCain's comments make you wonder how he got almost 60% of the vote up here? What, he ran for president?
It had something to do with his running mate.
Anyway.
He had a running mate you may have heard of, Michael. I believe her name is Sarah Palin, that's right.
Yes.
Well, you know, McCain is really not that liked in Alaska. You know, before Palin got picked to be his VP running mate, I talked to a lot of Alaskans, including those who were going to the Republican convention, who were like, I'm not really too fond of this guy. He doesn't like want to drill in ANWR, which is part of the Republican platform in Alaska. He doesn't like the earmarks. And so there's not a lot of love between Alaska and John McCain. Congressman Young a couple weeks ago told me that he thinks McCain has a, quote, screw loose. So there's a lot of rhetoric flying.
That's a technical term, I believe.
But let me mention one thing that John McCain brought up. He actually used an Alaskan's own words to argue his case. He quoted Andrew Halcrow, former state legislator, who recently wrote an editorial piece that asked if it was time for Alaska to grow up and start really paying its own way more. And McCain said, you know, as states are really struggling with their budgets, Alaska's got quite a bit of money, thanks to the permanent fund and thanks to the money that's in reserves. And so maybe it's time for Alaska to pick up more of the slack.
And Libby, finally, whether there's anybody with a screw loose or not in this debate, the biggest difficulty here, I think, facing Alaska is we're going to have this debate every year.
Yes, and not only in this program, but in programs across the board, like the Denali Commission, we're really seeing that moment now where programs that Senator Ted Stevens, in some ways created, long championed, are really going to be hitting the cutting block. And as Republicans, as well as Democrats, look for ways to cut money from the budget, these programs are going to be targeted repeatedly. Don Young has a measure that he got in the FAA bill over on the House side that left committee this week that would actually allow the Essential Air Service program to be cut everywhere except Alaska and Hawaii. So he's able to use some of his pull and seniority there to try to get some of these Alaskan exemptions.
And Senator Inouye of Hawaii is chairman of the Appropriations Committee on the Senate side. Paul, the FBI releases some of its files on former Senator Ted Stevens. They are voluminous. What did we learn?
Out of 2,751 pages, not much. The current the most recent investigation of Ted Stevens and political corruption in Alaska, there's very little new in there. If you're looking for something that would shed light on that, I think you'd be disappointed. What was interesting to me was the historical value of some of the information, including Stevens's tiffs with the FBI going back to the mid-50s, from one of his criticisms of the FBI for not following up on an escaped prisoner. And down the years, they have never forgotten that, apparently. And it was,
or at least J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover surely didn't. He didn't make the enemies list, but I guess he probably came
close.
Isn't
it, and it's also true, there's one thing that you could learn from that period of time. The FBI and local prosecutors were exchanging, the FBI in Washington, were exchanging mail, telegrams, That's telephone right. calls.
All the time. They were very close-knit.
Okay, let's turn to Steve. Steve, what do we know about the continuing investigation, if it's continuing?
If it's continuing, yeah. And this would be the Polar Pack.
That'd be one of them,
That was one of several, I guess. We really haven't heard anything. And it's been the case throughout all of these investigations that started with Bill Allen and all, we didn't get any details really until there were indictments and the trials that began. And we certainly haven't gotten any information on whether or not this investigation is ongoing. This one involved former state senator Ben Stevens, the son of Ted Stevens, and as well as Senator Stevens and others. The most we know about it was done by the Anchorage Daily News. They did some really good investigative reporting a couple of years back on this and put out as much information as they were able to garner, but nothing really from the FBI.
This is the way this seems to be working is we'll be going along, and then one day there'll be perhaps something of a bombshell or at least a big story,
right?
Or it'll just go along and we won't hear anything.
Right, it'll come out of the blue. Somebody's been indicted. I don't think they'll call and say, hey, guess what? We are not indicting anybody at all. I don't think they really do that. It's pretty much so-and-so has been arrested and they're in cuffs down at wherever, you know.
Thank you, Steve. I wanted to take a moment to comment on the FBI papers and some of what Paul mentioned, because I've been very interested in them and done quite a lot of work on Ted Stevens' early history. The papers are that the FBI released are in some measure frustrating to deal with because there's so many of them and they can lock up your computer, and many of them are news stories. And then there are others of which have been redacted, names have been removed, places have been removed. And what's so exasperating about that is in Ted Stevens' case in Fairbanks, there were stories that had been in the newspaper that had been parts of lawsuits that the whole public at that time knew about, yet the government has gone into these documents and taken out the names of the participants. And Ted Stevens was in several disputes, and one of them was with a businesswoman named Grace Lowe, and she was all over him and threatened to sue him, and he got back at her. I mean, it was a very tumultuous time, and he was a vigorous participant in it. But the government didn't do any historical researchers any favor by taking out the names and references to a whole bunch of events that had already been in the newspaper. But enough complaints from journalists. Libby Casey, Senator Murkowski goes to the White House to visit President Obama, and they talk Alaska.
Yes, and Michael, can I just say one thing? Because as you were talking, I was reflecting on pouring through those many pages of Ted Stevens' files. And it was disappointing as a journalist because there just wasn't a lot of meat in there as far as what happened during the investigation of Ted Stevens, why were they looking into his record, and then what went wrong. But remember that there are still two investigations right now ongoing into the prosecutors and the FBI and their case against Ted Stevens. So a lot of that is still behind closed doors, and we're just waiting to see if anything really comes of it. But
on
to Lisa Murkowski and the White House. So she went to the White House this week on Wednesday. What came of it? We don't really know, because her staff is not saying. They would only say that she requested the meeting and that it was to talk about a range of Alaskan issues. The White House would only say that they discussed the need for bipartisan energy legislation. Lisa Murkowski is seen as kind of a linchpin player right now in the energy debate. The White House wants to get support for having a clean energy standard. And so we're not really talking about renewables anymore. We're talking about clean energy. The difference is that quote unquote clean includes natural gas. It also includes hydroelectric, which Alaska's big on. And so they're trying to get support of moderate Republicans, energy advocates like Lisa Murkowski on board with their plan. But she gave Secretary Chu, the Energy Secretary, a pretty tough time when he came to testify before the Energy Committee this week. Right before her White House meeting, he was talking about the president's budget, and she did not really like it. She's got some criticisms about where it really puts the money. It invests a lot more in renewables like wind and solar, and less in things like natural gas and hydropower. Her staff this today on the Energy Committee put out a notice saying, "Hey, hope you saw this story in Politico today that talks about Lisa Murkowski." A Politico reporter got her in the hall yesterday and asked her if it was true that Harry Reid, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, he had mentioned that Murkowski was part of this bipartisan group working on a clean energy standard, and Lisa Murkowski said, "I'm not part of it, haven't had that conversation with them." So they're trying to do some pushback. I think they don't want her to look too moderate or too much of a player with the White House. They're trying to keep her independent streak going on right now.
Okay. Libby, let's stick with you on one more thing, and that is Governor Parnell has announced that he's going to follow a Florida Circuit Court judge, and he's not going to enforce the Obama health care law because Parnell has decided it's unconstitutional, and he would be violating his oath of office if he did. How's that apt to go over back there?
You know, it's interesting because not only is Parnell saying we're not going to do it, he's also chosen to reject money. And so Alaskans are not getting money that the feds have said, here's money to go ahead and start putting together a consumer marketplace so that members of your state, citizens of your state, can go online and figure out what's the best insurance deal for me and my family. Parnell said, we don't want that money.
As a matter of fact, he called it, I can't see you to give you hand signals, but as a matter of fact, Parnell called it a tainted shiny apple.
And so Alaskans won't get that. And members of the state legislature, like Hollis French, are upset about that. And they're saying, look, if this money is out here, it can actually help Alaskans. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the mandate that everyone has insurance. That's a separate issue from some of these other opportunities. But the White House is pushing back, and they're saying that this is still federal law, and that until it works its way up to the Supreme Court, the White House is pushing for states to enact it. So there may be a bit of a power struggle here. Elements of the bill that are the most controversial don't even come into play for a couple of years yet. So we'll see if Alaskans want or don't want some of the other elements of the bill that are less controversial.
Okay, thank you very much, Libby. Steve, your assessment of the Governor Parnell's somewhat surprising move.
Yeah, well, again, there's two judges that have said that it's unconstitutional. The health care reform bill is unconstitutional. Two judges that have said that, no, it's fine. It meets muster and passes muster. And he's going with the latter one, the one in Florida that said it was unconstitutional. So he's been dubious of the whole health care reform.
And there would be a constituency out there that would agree with him strongly.
Absolutely. Yeah, oh, absolutely, including in this state. There again, Alaskans haven't been willing to pass up on federal money in the past. I don't know how most Alaskans will feel about that this time around. But
tempt me not, you fiend.
Right. And by the way, a tainted apple a day keeps the doctor away.
Okay. So, Michael, if I could jump in real
Please.
Quick. I think a lot of people across the country don't understand what's actually in the bill. And that's a failure of the White House to brand it better and Democrats to really educate the public better. I've covered this for quite a while now in an in-depth way, and I still have questions about exactly some of the content and what it would mean down the line. And so I don't know yet if Alaskans realize what they'd be missing out on if the governor refuses money. And so I think that's part of our job as reporters to dig into what it would mean. Do people care? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But there's still a lot we need to dig into to figure out what the implications of both the law is and also what Governor Parnell's rejection would mean.
And something else, Libby, too, is in the past election cycle that we just saw, many of the people who supported it, voted for it, stepped away from it during the election. They was nuclear to a lot of candidates. So even the supporters, the folks who voted it in, want nothing to do with it publicly, it seems.
And if I might go back to Libby, there are parts of this that are very desirable to many Alaskans. Pre-existing conditions, for example, how they would be treated under the legislation, and the fact that you'd be able to, families would be able to continue to insure younger adults.
That's right. And like the consumer marketplace I was talking about, a place where you could go online and kind of help figure out what plan best fits your needs. So there are elements that are ranking well in the public opinion in polls, but it's this idea of the mandate, the idea that you must have insurance that's been so controversial, and that's what Parnell's jumping on with.
Let's get Paul in here real quickly. We have about a minute and a half, Paul.
Jump. Say something clever.
The Parnell administration has been kind of giving this the skunk eye from day one. It doesn't surprise me that he would reject the federal money if he had to avoid having to implement the law that he sees as unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. He's gotten legal advice from the Department of Law, says he can do it, and I think that's where he's headed.
I think you're covered for skunk eye under the health care.
That's under the health care 8G provision.
Yeah, we'll take care of that.
Paul, the liquor industry and its allies want to change the location of the regulatory agency, the ABC, that deals with liquor, moving it into the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Where's this headed?
The liquor industry says ABC treats us like criminals. How dare they? We want to move this to Commerce where they worry about making money. The other side, public health people, advocates, alcoholism, treatment facilities, that sort of thing, say, no, this is a great idea. They need to be watched closely. Department
well,
of Public
and,
Safety
and
is where
I
it needs
I
to be.
I think that the public, just generally speaking, many of them are going to think the liquor industry is overregulated.
Well, it's over. Yeah, there you go.
We're overregulated because we're out of time. Thank you for joining us, Libby Casey from Washington, D.C., and good day, good night to you all.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.